We turn now from the hurricane ripping across Cuba to a happier time, the 1950s, when you could hear this on the radio every night.
Bacardí, la bebida cubana que alegra al mundo entero, presenta De Fiesta con Bacardí.
Party with Bacardi was the hit show presented by the premier Cuban company Bacardi Rum. It was an era when Cuba was the tourist capital of the Caribbean, an island of tropical delights, nightclubs, and casinos. NPR correspondent Tom Gelton has written a new book. It's called Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. It's about the Bacardi family and the family's fortunes, which he writes have been intertwined with Cuba's ever since Cuba's wars for independence from Spain during the mid-1800s when the company was founded.
Rum, up until that period, was really, you'd have to say, it was a man's drink, and it was a rough man's drink. I mean, it was drunk by sailors and, you know, buccaneers, and was a very harsh in its taste. And Facundo Bacardi, the founder of the Bacardi Rum Company, decided to make rum a much lighter drink, one that would be enjoyed by a broader group of consumers, and one that could be mixed with other things. And of course, Coca-Cola became famous, and the daiquiri and so forth.
And the thread of revolution starts with the son of the founder of Bacardi, who was involved in Cuba's war of independence from Spain in the 19th century.
Right, Renee. That's Emilio Bacardi, who's the first Bacardi born in Cuba, was arrested twice and exiled to Spain for years on end. He is the original person that intertwined this kind of entrepreneurial identity as the president of Bacardi Rum with this nationalist political identity as one of the real patriots of the Cuban independence movement.
So how do these two things mesh, if they do at all, with how Bacardi was run as a company, putting out quite a famous product, popular as a party drink?
It's interesting that in the late 19th century, just as the Bacardi family was deeply involved in this anti-Spanish struggle, they were at the same time trying to court favor with the Spanish crown and actually were named as the purveyor to the royal household. One of the ways that they really established their reputation as a Cuban company was by emphasizing their patriotic credentials and their close association with Cuba. One of their first advertising slogans, Renee, was "The one that has made Cuba famous." And this was because many American tourists came to Cuba, and one of the things they enjoyed doing in the 1920s and 1930s and after was to drink rum. And so Bacardi became associated with Cuba in the mind of tourists, in the minds of Cubans, both for its political profile and for its contribution to sort of the cultural image of Cuba.
So then it was a natural, Tom, that this family would support the revolution in the 50s led by Fidel Castro?
You're right. The Bacardi relationship with the Cuban Revolution was, in many ways, a sort of a carryover of 100 years of involvement in, you know, what they regarded as progressive causes in Cuba and Cuban nationalistic movements. When Fidel Castro came to power in 1959, there was no Cuban company more closely associated with the revolution than the Bacardi Rum Company. Pepin Bosch, who was the chairman of Bacardi Rum at that time, gave tens of thousands of dollars of his own money to buy weapons for Castro's rebels, as did other members of the Bacardi family. And it was really a year and a half after Fidel was in power that the Bacardis finally turned against him. And it came only after Fidel expropriated all their properties in Cuba. This was in October 1960, and when almost all the Bacardis then went into exile.
Tom, tell us the story of the Bacardi family member who actually plotted or hoped to attack Castro's Cuba.
Right, Renee. This is Pepin Bosch, the Bacardi chief and the same businessman who was so close to the revolutionary movement in the 1950s and then, of course, turned against it. His son, Carlos Bosch, living in exile in South Florida in the early 1960s, had this idea of starting an air freight business. But then for some reason, he couldn't get the requisite permissions from the U.S. aviation authorities to go ahead with his business. And finally, he says to his father, Pepin Bosch, "For some reason, I can't get the approval bills to get this business going. I have no idea what's the problem. And his father says, maybe it's the plane I'm keeping in Costa Rica. Pepin Bosch then proceeds to tell him that he has bought a B-26 bomber and he is looking for someone to fly it on bombing missions to Cuba. In fact, it never happened. He was never able to find anyone to fly that mission. But it's just an example of one of the many sabotage activities that were hatched in those first crazy years after Fidel came to power. And the Bacardis, as leading members of the Cuban exile community, were involved in a good number of them.
But the Bacardis did continue to do in exile quite well, didn't they? In fact, in some respects, even better.
That's really true, Renee. I mean, partly it reflects some very farsighted decisions they made in the 1950s at a time when their biggest enemy was Batista, the Cuban dictator, and they actually worried that because of their political profile in Cuba in the 1950s, the Batista regime might move against them. And so you saw in the 1950s the creation of independent companies outside Cuba. And this made it much easier for the Bacardis to reorganize without their Cuban assets, without their Cuban headquarters.
What is the likelihood that in a post-Castro era, the Bacardi family and Bacardi rum will return to Cuba?
Again, one of the things about this whole Bacardi story is that there is a deep Cuban identity in this company, and it is a family company, Renee. To this day, even though it's worth billions and billions of dollars, it's still almost entirely owned by the Bacardi family. And so you would see the Bacardis then going back to Cuba in a way sort of representative of all that Cuban exile capital, Cuban exile money that could conceivably be made available in the rebuilding of Cuba. Just as the Bacardis have been a big force in Cuba for over a century, I think we cannot at all discount the possibility that they could be a force in Cuba in the future.
Tom, thanks very much.
It's my pleasure, Renee.
NPR's Tom Gelton is the author of Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, the Biography of a Cause. Read an excerpt from the book and view a gallery of vintage Bacardi ads at our website, npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. This election season has been filled with charges of media bias. It was a recurring theme at last week's Republican convention, and many Republicans have directed their criticism at the cable channel MSNBC and its co-anchor Keith Olbermann. Now MSNBC says it will not be using Olbermann and fellow talk show host Chris Matthews to anchor some of the channel's election newscasts this fall. They will, however, continue to host their nightly programs. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik joins us now from our bureau in New York. And David, what gives?
Well, there's been this tension between the role of Keith Olbermann, who is this liberal primetime nightly talk show host for MSNBC, and the idea that he and Chris Matthews, a fellow liberal talk show host for MSNBC, would be anchoring. The immediate cause was last week at the Republican National Convention. It flared up when the Republicans showed this video about 9/11, presumably to remind people of that terrible day, with very vivid footage. Olbermann said, this should not have been shown by the Republicans, shouldn't have been shown by the network. I believe we have a clip about that.
If you reacted to that videotape the way I did, I apologize. It is a subject of great pain for many of us still, and was probably not appropriate to be shown.
And the question about whether it was appropriate for an anchor to be making that point of view came up. Olbermann and MSNBC say that he brought up that question and that he thought he should be perhaps wearing a different hat. This has to, however, be seen in the context of the campaign. You know, Matthews and Olbermann have been anchoring MSNBC's coverage since the beginning of the year for the political events, major primary nights and the like. The Clinton campaign during the primary, Senator Hillary Clinton felt that MSNBC was far too pro-Obama. And the McCain campaign has made the same case as well. This has even flared up on the air. There's been tension between Olbermann and, say, former Republican Congressman Joe Scarborough, who's also one of their hosts, about whether or not the station's being fair.
Well, just briefly, let's look back. Why did MSNBC elevate Matthews and Olbermann to anchoring duties?
No show on MSNBC in its dozen years has fared as well in the ratings as Keith Olbermann's Countdown for the network, and it's been they've sort of backed in this position where they found that if they give voice to their liberal host, they seem to have shown a fair degree of rating success. One of his proteges, Rachel Maddow, this week is making her debut in a show following his.
So, what does it mean for NBC News, which runs, of course, MSNBC?
Well, NBC News sees itself as an objective, even-handed, non-ideological source of news, and it's been a source of real tension. If you watched the conventions last week, you heard at times chants on the floor by delegates of NBC, NBC, as a jeer when speakers from the podium would assail the liberal media elites. That can't be good. It's been a source of some concern for people like former NBC Nightly News anchor Tom Brokaw. You know, Phil Griffin is the president of MSNBC. He said that Olbermann and Matthews knew how to walk the line. But, clearly there's some discomfort in the two hats.
Well, given everything that people have to watch nowadays politically, in a sense, you want to say, well, why not just turn the dial?
Well, and that's certainly doable. What you're seeing now is the question of the evolution of whether or not media outlets can have a strong point of view. You know, Fox News is often seen as being very conservative, particularly with its talk show hosts, although it says, its reporters are straight down the line. The difference is Fox News doesn't have its political conservative hosts serve as their anchors.
David, thanks very much. NPR's David Folkenflik from our studios in New York. Much of the coverage following the announcement that the U.S. government is taking over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac has focused on how this will affect the U.S. mortgage industry. But there's something that might be even more important. These U.S. mortgage giants are central tools in maintaining the U.S. position in the world economy. NPR's Adam Davidson reports.
We are going to talk about how the global economy works here, but it's going to be fun. There's no jargon, I promise. In fact, in a minute or so, you'll meet a real amusement park sideshow carny. But first, some basics. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were designed by Congress to serve one purpose, to allow more Americans to buy homes. They do this by effectively making mortgages cheaper. But over the past few years, entirely by accident, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have taken on a new role. They recycle the dollars we send to China back into the United States. Let me explain by taking you to Coney Island in Brooklyn, New York. The city is holding an electronics recycling program here today in a parking lot. People drive up, a bunch of city staffers take the junk electronics out of their cars. Like, here's Anita and Eric Posen.
What'd you get rid of?
Printer.
It looked like a new one.
No, I have a new printer. That's why I got rid of this one. So hopefully somebody can use it.
Where do you think they made that printer?
Probably overseas.
Probably Red China.
Japan? I don't know.
Did you have to borrow money to get the new printer?
It's on the credit card.
Well, we did borrow money, but it's on the credit card.
There are massive piles of computers and TVs and printers. A sanitation official says it's around 30 tons, 60,000 pounds. And this is one day. They do a bunch of these each year. Much of this stuff, probably most, was made in China. We buy a lot more from China than they buy from us each year. That's what the trade deficit means. Every day, China ends up with about a billion new U.S. dollars. What do they do with all that money? Well, China lends it back to us. That has been a central dynamic in the world economy for years. U.S. consumers buy a lot of stuff from China. China lends the money back to us. And then we buy more stuff from China. China doesn't just give each of us credit cards or a bank loan, obviously. What they do is much more massive. It's lending money wholesale. The way China does it? Well, one of the main ways is they buy bonds issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Anybody else? So win there every game, we'll get a prize every time. Come on in, sweetheart. You'll have a seat. You'll have a seat here. Who else wants it?
The recycling event is right next door to the down-on-its-luck Coney Island Carnival Arcade. Howie Montebianco is running a game called Kentucky Derby. You throw rubber balls into these little holes, then the balls roll out and you throw them in again.
And the more balls you get in, the quicker your Kentucky Derby horse advances.
That's Gina Quattrochi. She told me she runs an organization for people with AIDS. I told her I want to use this Kentucky Derby game as an analogy for the U.S.-China financial relationship. To my shock, she jumped right in.
So the balls are dollars.
The balls are dollars, or $1 trillion.
Or trillion dollars
in trade deficit.
And you're throwing the dollars to China.
We're throwing the dollars to China.
And then they send the dollars back.
Right. So we can buy more things that we can't afford.
The U.S. government rescued Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac yesterday, and they rescued the recycling process that gets our money for the things we buy from China back to us in the form of loans so we can buy some more stuff. A lot of economists say this is not sustainable in the long run, but it would be really painful to lose it in the short run. Adam Davidson, NPR News.
The political funny bone. I'm Alex Chadwick. 57 days remaining until the general election. Just in time, contributing writer Brian Unger offers help for all you voters out there.
Are you having trouble deciding who's best experienced for public office? Hello, I'm Brian Unger of the Unger Report. I'm confident that I speak for millions of Americans who, as I do, suffer from a painful, embarrassing condition that for a week has gone ignored by mental health professionals. I'm talking about political dementia, PD. When you can't tell the difference between the experienced and inexperienced, good experience from bad experience, and worthless experience from valuable inexperience. Who has PD, political dementia? Usually you'll find them sitting alone in front of a TV listening to the experienced argue for the value of experienced inexperience. Symptoms of PD include disorientation, lightheadedness, forgetfulness, a rattled, imbalanced feeling, usually accompanied by a sensitivity to light and the dreamy, blue, laser-like gaze of Anderson Cooper. Political dementia, PD, is triggered by exposure to excessive campaign rhetoric from pundits and politicians who begin to break down common sense, obliterate your instinct, and force you to rethink and question all that you've held as true. Not to mention all the flatulence and bloating. PD can be humiliating. A condition that causes people to withdraw into a world of ambivalence, confusion, and in extreme cases, makes them inexplicably undecided. People with PD wonder, does a lot of experience make one seasoned and skilled, or old and out of touch? Is a little experience better when one knows just enough to be effective? Or is that dangerous on-the-job training? For example, how much experience is needed to handle, say, nuclear weapons, or manage the people whose job it is to handle nuclear weapons, or handle the managers of nuclear weapons handlers? Confusing, isn't it? I used to think a person needed a lot of experience to be the boss of a nuclear power, but now I'm not so sure. Sometimes I think it would be better to have someone really inexperienced, say a brand new person to the whole nuclear racket, someone who could bring a fresh, untainted approach to the whole radiation thing. There goes my PD talking again. If you can't discern the value of experience or inexperience, or if you yourself are experienced and are arguing on behalf of someone inexperienced, chances are you too have political dementia. PD symptoms may intensify as Halloween approaches. Many PD sufferers find relief in early November. However, PD is a cyclical disease and may erupt on a quadrennial basis. Consult an experienced professional or a professional in inexperience. And that is today's Unger Report. I'm Brian Unger.
Well, now a very different kind of change coming to many college and university campuses. To save money and energy, some schools are getting rid of that old lunchroom mainstay, the tray. Sandy Hausman of member station WVTF reports.
It's lunchtime at one of the University of Virginia's cafeterias, and third-year biology major Graydon Bowman is enjoying some of her favorite foods.
Pizza, onion rings, taco salad, yeah, and some home fries doused in some sort of cheese sauce.
But it now takes Bowman three trips through the cafeteria to amass her meal because the university no longer provides trays. Dining director Brett Barringer says the decision came after his company, food service giant Aramark, studied 25 campus cafeterias and learned it takes a half gallon of water to clean a single tray.
About 35% of the water we use goes to just washing trays. Plus, add into that the electricity to run the dish machines, the soap used, all those kinds of things. It's just absolutely huge.
At Georgia Tech, for example, managers figured they could save 3,000 gallons of water a day. And with parts of the South still battling a multi-year drought, 80% of students surveyed at UVA said they were willing to make the sacrifice, among them Caroline Higgins.
It is a little inconvenient, but at the same time, I think it's worth it for the drought and saving water.
But many students, including sophomore pre-med Amy Rogers and Matt McDonald, a second year majoring in mechanical engineering, say no trays, no way.
All I have is a soup and like a side, and I can't even carry my drink, so I miss the trays, yeah.
It wastes my energy to go back and get everything. It takes up time and it clogs all the cafeteria up with everyone walking around having to get their stuff again, whereas you can just make one trip, sit down, and then eat and leave.
But the trays are likely gone for good. Not only is their disappearance a plus for the environment, Barringer says, there are health and financial considerations. Aramark found students take about a quarter less food if they go trayless, a good thing with obesity on the rise. And he says less food is wasted.
In the average lunch, about 880 pounds of food waste was going right into the trash can.
Money saved on food and landfill charges might offset rising food and energy costs, holding the price of student meal plans down. So far, Aramark and rival Sodexo report more than 500 colleges and universities from California to Florida are on board. And Sodexo has introduced one more change in campus cafeterias, a device that prevents students from grabbing handfuls of napkins by dispensing one at a time. Sodexo spokesman Jaya Bowman says that's cut napkin use in half.
And what this has translated into in just 1 year is a savings of nearly 10 million gallons of water and more than 23,000 trees saved, 500,000 gallons of oil, and 5.5 million kilowatts of energy.
Bowman says trends often begin at universities, and this one, green dining in the cafeteria, is likely to spread to corporate locations. What's more, it's taking hold in high school lunchrooms, suggesting future college freshmen will find nothing controversial about conserving napkins and going trayless on campus. For NPR News, I'm Sandy Hausman in Charlottesville, Virginia.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The nomination of Sarah Palin as the Republican candidate for vice president has sparked a different kind of conversation about women in the workplace. National polls show the Alaska governor is very popular, but since she joined the GOP ticket, Palin has fueled a debate among women about working mothers. NPR's Tovia Smith reports.
Reaction to Palin's candidacy basically falls in two camps. There's the you go girl, and the how could you? And that question is coming from mothers across the political spectrum.
It's selfish on her part. Her kids need it. She has got a baby in diapers. I mean, she should be concerned about being there to put her kids to bed every night.
49-year-old Maria Martinangelo is a single mom who's always worked in a liberal-leaning suburb west of Boston. She says she's all for a woman in the White House, just not a woman who's got five kids, including a newborn with Down syndrome and a teenager about to have a baby herself.
Your children sacrifice for that. You know, daycare or somebody else is raising your kids. I may be politically incorrect in saying so, but it's how I feel.
For sure, some of the more bitter barbs against Palin are politically motivated, but even some social conservatives who are with Palin on the issues are expressing qualms about her running.
I think that's crazy.
48-year-old Maureen Zeff, a stay-at-home mother of three from Stratham, New Hampshire, says she was leaning Republican until Palin joined the ticket.
I think she's overambitious and her heart isn't in the right place. I hate to be judgmental that way, but my values are my children come first.
Oh my God, we're like in the dark ages. This is not up to us to decide how she runs her family.
45-year-old Michelle Collins doesn't agree with Palin on the issues, but she says she's appalled that anyone would even question whether it's proper for Palin to run.
I think it's outrageous for somebody to make the assumption that a woman can't do a job because she has children. How about hiring somebody? How about her husband or boyfriend? Or how about somebody else taking some of the slack up?
I can't help but wish we were beyond these debates, but you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out we haven't made enough progress yet.
Massachusetts former acting governor Jane Swift knows it all too well. She ran for lieutenant governor pregnant with her first baby and was acting governor when she delivered twins. She, too, was mocked and condemned for trying to pull off the breast pump BlackBerry Balancing Act. She eventually dropped out of politics. As she explained at the time, something has to give. But Swift says that's a decision that every parent has to make for her or himself.
I do recognize that how I choose to spend my time has an impact on my family, and so those are personal choices. But what I reject is when women are forced to justify those choices in ways that guys aren't.
Indeed, no one's questioning whether Barack Obama can still be a good father to his two young kids. Susan Reverby is a professor of women's studies at Wellesley College.
I see it as unfinished women's movement business, that there is a deep-seated belief that somehow what women give is different than what men can make available. And therefore, when men are at work, they are not required in some deep psychological way to think about their children in quite the same way as women are.
A study by the Pew Research Center shows Americans still disapprove of working moms by a 2-to-1 margin, and the numbers haven't really budged in the past 10 years. Some say that's partly because moms themselves tend to really dig their heels in once they take sides in the so-called mommy war.
I mean, it's a game face is what it is. It's like, oh yeah, got it covered, you bet. You bet.
Michelle Lamar hosts a blog about working moms. She says another reason the question of work-family balance continues to rage is because right now,
there is no good answer at all. And whatever you do, there are consequences, there is fallout.
Many moms hope it'll be one good thing that comes from the debate swirling around Sarah Palin. If it helps change policies around flex time, paid sick days, and maternity leave, they say, what Sarah Palin is doing might raise fewer eyebrows in the future. Tovia Smith, NPR News.